From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We are facing a massive catastrophe, which has caused damages that will require an enormous effort by both the public and private sectors.
More than 700 dead, 1.5 million affected in Chile following one of the strongest earthquakes in recorded history, 500 times more powerful than the earthquake in Haiti. Yet the scope of the destruction is a fraction of the hundreds of thousands dead in Haiti. We'll ask earthquake expert Roger Billum why. Then protests against racism at the University of California, San Diego, after a noose is found hanging in the main library, and white students hold what they call a Compton cookout. We'll speak with the co-chair of the Black Student Union at UC San Diego and with the director of the African American Studies Department and psychotherapist Gary Greenberg on manufacturing depression, the secret history of a modern disease. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Chile, the death toll from Saturday's earthquake has topped 700 and is expected to rise. As many as 2 million people have been left homeless. The 8.8 magnitude quake is one of the strongest in recorded history. More than 500,000 homes were destroyed or heavily damaged. Rescue workers are searching for survivors under the rubble of collapsed buildings, but a series of strong aftershocks have hampered the rescue efforts. The quake caused widespread damage to hospitals, schools, roads, and other infrastructure. Officials said adobe homes had been most affected and that indigenous populations are most at risk. A tsunami triggered by the earthquake caused additional damage in some southern areas of Chile. The earthquake hit less than 2 weeks before Chilean President Michelle Bachelet leaves office. On Sunday, she announced a series of emergency measures.
We are facing a massive catastrophe, which has caused damages that will require an enormous effort by both the public and private sectors, one of the largest efforts in the history of the country. This effort will be required both for now and for a period into the future. We are facing an emergency unprecedented in the history of Chile that will require an urgent and rapid response.
We'll have more on the earthquake in a few minutes. We'll be speaking with seismologist Roger Billum. The Washington Post reports the recent U.S. assault on the Afghan area of Marja is a prelude to larger military campaigns. Senior Obama administration officials say the United States has begun initial planning for a bigger, more complex offensive in Kandahar later this year. 11,000 U.S. and Afghan troops fought in Marja, making it the largest U.S.-NATO military operation since 2001. The city of Kandahar is 10 times larger than Marja. President Barack Obama has signed a one-year extension of several provisions in the Patriot Act after the Senate abandoned efforts to reform the controversial law. Privacy groups had urged the Senate to rewrite Section 215 of the bill, which allows the government to secretly access a wide range of private business records without warrant. But Senate Democrats failed to muster enough votes to rewrite the law. Another contested provision that remains in the law allows the government to secretly wiretap people without any connection to terrorists or spies under the so-called lone wolf provision. Meanwhile, newly released Pentagon documents reveal the U.S. military monitored Planned Parenthood and a white supremacist group as part of the government's security preparations for the 2002 Olympics in Utah. The documents also reveal that military intelligence spied on the anti-war group Alaskans for Peace and Justice in 2005. Other documents disclose that the military illegally intercepted civilian cell phone conversations in April 2007 during an exercise at Fort Polk in Louisiana. The documents were obtained by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Senate Banking Committee Chair Christopher Dodd has abandoned efforts to create an independent consumer financial protection agency. President Obama had proposed creating the agency to protect consumers against abuses in mortgages, credit cards, and other forms of lending. In its place, Dodds expected to propose the creation of a Bureau of Financial Protection inside the Treasury Department. Dodds' proposed bureau will have far less power and would not be allowed to enforce rules on banks with less than $10 billion in holdings or enforce rules against non-bank financial operations such as payday lenders. Dodds' decision is seen as a victory for Republicans and many business groups who've campaigned against forming a new agency to protect consumers. Unemployment benefits ended on Sunday for hundreds of thousands of Americans after Senate Republicans prevented a vote last week to fund extended benefits for people who've exhausted the basic 26 weeks of coverage. The Senate vote was blocked by a filibuster from Kentucky Republican Jim Bunning. Meanwhile, in the House, the Democratic leadership is struggling to get enough votes to pass a $15 billion jobs bill. Many progressive Democrats have criticized the legislation for focusing too much on tax breaks that will do little to create jobs. Congressmember Lynn Woolsey, the co-chair of the House Progressive Caucus, said, quote, "That's not a jobs bill. For us to call it that and then think we've accomplished something is a mistake," she said. Here in New York, Governor David Paterson withdrew from the state governor's race on Friday after being battered by questions of impropriety for his role in a domestic abuse case involving one of his top aides.
"Today I am announcing that I am ending my campaign for governor of the state of New York. It has become increasingly clear to me in the last few days that I cannot run for office and try to manage the state's business at the same time. And right now, New York State needs a leader who can devote full time to this service."
The New York Times revealed last week that Governor Paterson spoke with a woman who'd accused the governor's top aide of assault. After speaking with the governor, the woman failed to appear in court and her case was dismissed. The Wall Street Journal reports at least two of the 26 suspects sought by Dubai police for the alleged assassination of a top Hamas leader appear to have entered the United States shortly after his death. One of the suspects is said to have entered the U.S. on January 21st, one day after Mahmoud al-Babu's body was found in a Dubai hotel room. Dubai's police chief has said he is 99% certain Israel's Mossad intelligence agency is behind the killing. The United Nations General Assembly approved a resolution Friday calling for Israel and the Palestinians to conduct impartial investigations into war crimes committed during Israel's assault on Gaza last year, as documented in the Goldstone Report. The United States, along with Canada, Nauru, Panama, Macedonia and Micronesia, joined Israel in voting against the resolution. U.S. Deputy Ambassador Alejandro Wolf reiterated the U.S. view that the Goldstone Report is deeply flawed.
"We have previously noted shortcomings that include its unbalanced focus on Israel, the negative inferences it draws about Israel's intentions and actions, its failure to deal adequately with the asymmetrical nature of the Gaza conflict, and its failure to assign appropriate responsibility to Hamas for deliberately targeting civilians and basing itself and its operations in heavily civilian-populated urban areas."
The Palestinian Authority's permanent observer to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, criticized Israel and called for action.
"Acting above the law, Israel has inflicted untold suffering and devastation on the Palestinian people it has oppressed for over four decades in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and has its course gravely undermined the applicability and credibility of international law. It is high time to end and reverse this destructive, obscene pattern of behavior by Israel, and that begins with ensuring accountability by punishing those responsible for the perpetration of war crimes against innocent civilians and ensuring justice for the many victims of those crimes."
In news from Egypt, former nuclear watchdog Mohamed El-Baradei said Saturday he hasn't decided whether he will run for president and challenge Hosni Mubarak, who's ruled Egypt since 1981. El-Baradei has set strict conditions for any presidential bid, including a constitutional change to make it possible for independents to run and international monitoring.
"My first priority and my ultimate—my basic goal is to change Egypt into a democratic system. You know, whether I would run or not, that is a territory issue, in fact. And if you know, I would, as I said, I would only run if people coalesce around me and think that they want me to run as president. Whether I'll make a good president or not, well, remains to be seen if I run and if people should judge on performance.
Mohamed El-Baradei won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005 as head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. He's one of Egypt's most well-known international figures. In Haiti, massive flooding has killed at least 11 people in Lekai, Haiti's third-largest city. Heavy rains washed more than 60 inches of water into Lekai, flooding the city's hospital and prison. The city had not been badly affected by the earthquake. The United Nations has announced an independent board of scientists will be appointed to review the workings of the world's top climate science panel, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The IPCC has come under fire from skeptics of global warming after some mistakes were found in its 3,000-page report from 2007. Meanwhile, Nobel Peace Prize winner Al Gore has responded to global warming skeptics. In an op-ed piece published in the New York Times, Gore wrote, quote, "I, for one, genuinely wish that the climate crisis were an illusion. But unfortunately, the reality of the danger we're courting has not been changed by the discovery of at least two mistakes in the thousands of pages of careful scientific work over the last 22 years by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change." In news from West Virginia, a federal judge has granted Massey Energy a preliminary injunction aimed at blocking further protests at the company's coal mines by opponents of mountaintop removal coal mining. Massey sued five protesters in January in an effort to stop a year-long series of civil disobedience actions against the company. And the Center for American Progress has announced former White House Green Jobs Czar Van Jones will head the think tank's new Green Opportunity Initiative. Jones resigned from his White House job 5 months ago after becoming the target of what he described a vicious smear campaign. On Friday, Jones made one of his first public appearances since his resignation. He spoke at the NAACP Image Awards.
And I know one thing. We have people in every community in America right now watching this program who don't have jobs, who are suffering, who are afraid, living in economic uncertainty. And I know there's a future out there for them where they get a chance to make the products of tomorrow. If we want the jobs of tomorrow, we must make the products of tomorrow. There's somebody right now who's in Detroit and they know how to make cars. They're a skilled machinist, but they're idle. Let them make the wind turbines and the smart batteries and the solar panels to repower this country. Let them work. Give them hope. Give them the opportunity.
Van Jones receiving the NAACP President's Award. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. In Chile, rescue workers are searching for survivors under the rubble following Saturday's massive 8.8 earthquake, one of the strongest in recorded history. More than 700 people were killed, with the number expected to rise. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet has announced emergency measures to deal with the destruction. She said 1.5 million people have been affected by the earthquake and declared a state of catastrophe. A curfew has been put in place in some areas. The quake heavily damaged many of the country's roads, airports, and ports. It also triggered a tsunami that killed at least 4 people and caused serious damage to at least one port town, Concepcion, Chile's second largest city, about 300 miles south of Santiago, one of the hardest hit of the cities. The mayor has said food is running out and the situation is getting out of control. Thousands of people remain homeless. The army has been sent in to support local police. Security officials used tear gas and water cannons to disperse crowds who took food and supplies from a supermarket in Concepcion. But according to the New York Times, law enforcement authorities, heeding the cries of residents that they lacked food and water, eventually settled on a system that allowed staples to be taken, but not televisions and other electronic goods. Even as the people of southern Chile continue to grapple with death toll and the devastation wrought by the massive earthquake, many seismologists believe the wreckage could have been far worse. The 8.8 magnitude earthquake that struck Chile early Saturday morning was 500 times more powerful than the 7.0 magnitude quake that struck Haiti on January 12th. But it caused only a fraction of the casualties in comparison with the 300,000 people estimated to have died in Haiti. Seismologists suggest one reason for the difference in scale is that Chile enforced building codes for earthquake-resistant structures after the experience of a 9.0 magnitude earthquake 50 years ago in 1960. Earthquake expert Roger Billam argues it is quality of building construction and not simply the strength of the tremor that poses the most danger during an earthquake. He warns some of the fastest-growing cities in the Global South are also those facing significant seismic hazards, and the rapid pace of haphazard construction in these cities puts some 400 million people at risk. Billam was among the first seismologists to visit Haiti after the earthquake, and in a recent article in Nature magazine calls for the enforcement of earthquake-resistant construction guidelines. University of Colorado professor of geology and co-author with Susan Elizabeth Ho of After the Earthquakes, Elastic Rebound on an Urban Planet, Roger Billam joins me now from Denver, Colorado. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's very good,
good
to have you with us. Roger, can you start off by explaining the magnitude of the earthquake that has hit Chile and the scope of the damage?
Yes. A magnitude 8.8 earthquake is one of the biggest that you can have on the planet. In fact, the very largest we know about also happened in Chile in 1960, as you rightly point out. It had a magnitude of 9.5, much bigger than the one that's just occurred. However, the death toll in Chile during that earthquake was only 1,600 people. We may reach four figures in this earthquake, but we have to think of this as a tremendous success story. Earthquake-resistant construction prevails throughout Chile. They have an intelligent government that enforces these regulations, and they have constant reminders of what earthquakes can do. So although a tremendous number of buildings have been damaged, the buildings are damaged to the point that people can walk out of them. In Haiti, this did not occur. The buildings were shaken violently and completely pancaked in many cases because there was no earthquake resistance at all. And although Haiti has a history of earthquakes stretching back to the same period of time, Christopher Columbus obviously arrived in 1492, we don't know about earthquakes before then. Although Haiti has this extraordinary long history of earthquakes, the local government was completely unaware of the potential effects of bad building practices.
And when you talk about bad building practices, what exactly do you mean? What did Chile have that Haiti didn't have?
Well, first of all, there are various things that earthquake engineers insist on. The survival of certain critical structures, like hospitals, schools, fire stations, and so on, those have to survive earthquakes intact and operate the next few minutes after the shaking stopped. It turns out that some of these hospitals have been damaged, but probably not as many as could have. Now, what do you do to make a building safe from earthquakes? You need good quality foundations. Most buildings now going up are known as concrete skeleton designs. They have a structure of steel embedded in concrete. And you have to make sure you have the right kind of steel. If you use brittle steel, for example, the steel is simply snapped during an earthquake. What you need is ductile steel. It costs a little bit more. In Haiti, it was all brittle steel, steel without ribbon, even the little corrugations that hold the concrete together when a shaking commences. There are little structural members that look as though they're in place simply to hold the steel in place during pouring of the cement. Those things called stirrups. In fact, the stirrups used in Haiti were very weak, almost chicken wire type strength, whereas in Chile, I'm sure they applied the appropriate strength and thickness. And what these little pieces of metal do is stop the columns from exploding during the violent vertical shaking in an earthquake, then the quality of the cement matters. If you mix three parts of sand to one part of concrete, which is something they never tell you in school, but which most construction people know, you get good quality cement that doesn't fall to pieces in an earthquake. However, if you go down the beach and shovel some beach sand into a wheelbarrow and take it back to your building site without washing it or without checking, you know, exactly what it's got in it, it might have dirt or soil or it might have salt in, you finish up with a very weak cement. And it's all too tempting if you're building your own house, as must have occurred frequently in Haiti, to take four parts of sand or five parts of sand, making an extremely weak cement. Another thing is the addition of aggregate. When you build strong buildings, as an earthquake engineer would certainly be doing in Chile and have done, you use a very angular kind of aggregate. If you use rounded pebbles, the pebbles don't grab on the cement and they just fall to pieces. So there are a number of very obvious things that can be done, and fortunately, people are not told how to do this. You know, very frequently, the lowest paid workers turn up at a construction site and they're told to, you know, mix some cement, follow what that man is doing over there and assemble it. Well, if there's an engineer on board, it gets done right. If the man does it on his own, he may well be copying incorrect practices. And as a result, Haiti has duplicated a series of catastrophic designs that are weak from the foundations up and consequently fell down.
Professor Billam, are there an increased number of earthquakes? I mean, this weekend you have what happened in Chile. Also, wasn't there a small one in Pakistan? And then, of course, you had the horror in Haiti on January 12th. If you could talk about these and beyond in China and Pakistan in the past, in the United States.
Of course. Yes. The earthquakes are happening all the time. They've been happening for the last several billion years on our planet. And there's no change in their frequency. It looks like large earthquakes are happening suddenly now, a kind of conspiracy effect. No, it's just a statistical fluctuation. We have to worry about earthquakes that actually occur near population centres. We don't need to worry about earthquakes that happen in the middle of the ocean. Nobody's there, just a few fish. So what really matters is where our populations are. And one of the most unexpected things is if you make a map of the world and plop down all the cities that you know about, the very largest of them, probably half of them, are located on plate boundaries. Plate boundaries is where earthquakes occur. Now, supposing you were coming in from a distant galaxy and you wanted to populate the planet, you would try to avoid those places. But we have grown up on this planet and we found that plate boundaries are, in fact, very desirable places to live. They're on the seashore. There's usually a good trading arrangement. Even inland, near mountain belts, which are plate boundaries, like the Himalaya and parts of Iran and so on, the cities are often located near sources of water. And these sources of water come out at range fronts. In other words, all the most desirable places on our planet appear to be populated by very, very large cities. Now, if you wind the clock back 150 years, you find that these were only villages. The population of the world has increased tenfold in the repeat time of most damaging earthquakes on our planet. And so we have set up a disaster waiting to happen in probably 100 cities with populations more than a million people. One could list these 100 cities, and probably two or three of these will be damaged in the next two or three decades. A completely unacceptable prediction. It should not be possible for us to say that we're going to lose another 500,000 people. 650,000 people have died from earthquakes just since 2000. That's up almost fourfold since the previous two decades. And you could ask, well, why is this? Well, it's partly a statistical fluctuation in the locations of large earthquakes that are occurring, and it's partly a recurrence of these big earthquakes to cities that were former villages only 200 years ago. We know their history of earthquakes, and we know they will have a future of earthquakes. And so many of these cities, mostly in the developing nations, are slated for demolition by earthquakes. You know, it's a well-known phrase is that earthquakes don't kill people, buildings do. And we're now seeing that buildings are, in fact, weapons of mass destruction. And in fact, it's to me, completely unacceptable that we should live in a world where you can shake the ground a little bit and the building will fall down. It's just nonsense. We know how to do it right. It's just that we haven't done it right.
How does that kind of building get enforced, the kind of building regulations you're talking about?
Building inspectors are designed to come and watch every stage of a building's assembly in the U.S. You can't put a building up in California or in Colorado, even, without someone watching over your shoulder at every step of the moment. You can't go to the next step until you've received your certificate. In a place like Karachi or Tehran, building codes are now being enforced, and that's something that's happening officially. However, in some parts of the world, it's possible to talk to your building inspector and say, why don't you come tomorrow after I poured the concrete? Here's a few hundred dollars to look the other way. And you might think, well, how can anyone be so stupid as to assemble a building without sufficient strength? The answer is you can save money. And in the developing nations, there is this battle between what should be done and human nature, trying to either overtly make profits or covertly just to save money for the builders.
And also the issue of poverty.
You know, very often these build. Yes, in Haiti, seismologists, my colleagues, told the Haitians that, in fact, large earthquakes were overdue, and they'd happened a few hundred years ago. And there was enough strain now developed at the plate boundary to repeat a sequence of events that happened in the 1700s. This knowledge is like kind of dream on. There are so many problems that Haiti had that even if they'd started to act on retrofitting these buildings, it would have taken 2-3 decades. And there was no money for this. There are much more pressing issues.
Finally, are there man-made situations or phenomena that are increasing the number of earthquakes? Does anything human beings do on Earth have an effect on earthquakes, the number of earthquakes or their intensity?
Not really. I can't say that it doesn't happen at all. If you build a very large dam, you sometimes trigger an earthquake. But what we're watching is just the relentless movement of the plates and what the Earth has in store for us are usually 100 magnitude 7 earthquakes a year. Our future disasters depend whether those earthquakes occur close to cities that are vulnerable to shaking or whether they occur away from these cities. And it's a hit or miss problem. But I forecast that it is possible now to have something that has never happened in Earth's history, an earthquake killing perhaps 1 million people. And how can you make such a ridiculous prediction? The answer is that never before have we had such large populations at risk from earthquakes, cities of 12 million. And there are many cities like this, and several of them, like Istanbul and Tehran, have a history of damaging earthquakes, and we may well see the effects of corruption and bad building practices revealed only after these earthquakes have struck.
Finally, do you predict an earthquake in the United States anytime soon?
Well, we're very careful not to predict earthquakes. We tried that with a harmless earthquake in a field of cows at Parkfield a few years ago and failed miserably. What we can do, though, is forecast earthquakes, meaning that we know earthquakes will occur in something like a 30-year window. And on the San Andreas Fault, of course, there are a couple of large earthquakes overdue, one near Palm Springs. It might reach up into the L.A. region through Palmdale and so on. That earthquake is known to be ripe, sufficiently mature to happen any day. It may not happen for 100 years, but it's certainly something they're expecting. And, of course, earthquake resistance is pretty good in L.A. I mean, the houses are made of wood, earthquake-resistant design prevails throughout. But there is a much larger earthquake that could occur, and that is from Cape Mendocino northwards through Oregon up to Washington State. We are expecting in this country a magnitude 9 earthquake. This could occur now. It may not occur for 100 years, but it will. And when it does, it will test those building regulations that have been put into effect in places like Seattle. There is a large building stock that hasn't had the benefit of earthquake-resistant construction from the start. One can think of a lot of masonry buildings that will be damaged. There will also be a very large tsunami. And, yeah, this is something that's definitely going to occur in our future or the next generation. And I think we are more or less ready for it. Certainly much better prepared than Haiti and as well prepared as Chile.
Roger Billam, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of geology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, co-author with Susan Elizabeth Ho of After the Earthquakes, Elastic Rebound on an Urban Planet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Explosions in the sky. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we go now to California, where crowds of students stormed and occupied the office of a University of California San Diego chancellor for 6 hours Friday after a noose was found hanging from a bookcase in the main library. The incident prompted angry protests from students across the UC-wide system and denunciations from UC President Mark Udoff and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The unidentified student who admitted to hanging the noose was suspended. But racial tensions still run deep at UC San Diego, where the noose is only the latest in a string of incidents over the past few weeks. Protests were initially sparked by an off-campus party last month they called Compton Cookout that mocked Black History Month and denigrated African-American women. UC San Diego has the smallest percentage of African-American students in the 9-campus UC system. The Black Student Union at UC San Diego has declared the campus climate for racial minorities to be in a, quote, state of emergency. The students called on the university to increase its stated commitment to diversity by recruiting more students of color and providing greater support for ethnic studies departments and resource centers for underrepresented students. For more, I'm joined now in San Diego by the co-chair of the Black Student Union from the University of California, San Diego, Vinan Kevlegsky, and Daniel Widener, associate professor of history and faculty director of the African-American Students Minor at UC San Diego. He co-authored a letter from the African-American faculty expressing their, quote, disgust at the racist and misogynist events and calling on the university administration to provide the necessary resources to improve the climate on campus. We're going to start with Daniel Widener, director of the African-American Studies minor at UC San Diego. Just further explain these events, please.
Well, good morning, Amy. I think the most important thing for viewers and listeners to understand is that the students are battling not only a campus climate of intense hostility that Fanon will also detail, but a tremendous amount of history. The California voters have passed a series of racist initiatives really over the last 40 years, opposing fair housing, dismantling affirmative action, criminalizing youth, attempting to criminalize undocumented immigrant populations. So there's really a social basis for an intense racism that aims to maintain black people as a surplus population to be jailed and Latino people as a disposable population to be kept as a semi-permanent socioeconomic underclass. So education is a critical part of that, and on a campus where our numbers are almost a statistical anomaly, we face just a tremendous amount of both neglect and active hostility.
Fanon Kovlevsky, co-chair of the UC San Diego Black Student Union. These most recent events, can you start off by explaining what the so-called Compton cookout was?
So the Compton cookout, which was hosted and organized by different UCSD students, was in honor of Black History Month, and it was basically making a mockery of everything that we were celebrating for Black History Month on our campus and allowing students to experience the ghetto and different aspects of the ghetto by dressing a certain way and eating certain food and listening to certain music. But they definitely described what students should wear in a very detailed and dehumanizing and demoralizing way. We were all very shocked to read the description, as well as a lot of other students and faculty and staff. A lot of folks thought it was a joke at first, but the party did happen that Monday.
I'm just amazed as I look at this Facebook invitation that urged women to dress as ghetto chicks who, quote, usually have gold teeth, start fights and drama, and wear cheap clothes. It said the menu would include chicken and watermelon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have—
Yeah, that's right.
Professor Widener.
No. I just wanted to say that that was really only the first of a string of subsequent incidents. And it's important for people to understand that those incidents continue and the new ones are coming to light. We had a student who had trash thrown on her in the residence hall. We've had students intimidated in large lecture courses where you may have 400 or 500 students and may have one or two African-Americans at most. We had, of course, the incident that people have heard about of the noose being hung in the library. And we've had some off-campus incidents in restaurants and other public spaces. So our position, our feeling, is that the climate is worsening for students and that students are expressing tremendous concern about their safety, a fear of attending classes, a fear of being on the campus. And we get word now of the beginnings of a really racist counter-mobilization aimed at repudiating the suggestions, the demands that the students have made for how to implement a better campus climate. So the situation really is polarizing between the people who see these outbreaks of racist hostility as a problem or an embarrassment and people who are prepared to defend them.
And the fact that UC San Diego has the smallest percentage of African-American students in the 9-campus UC system, Fanon, do you think that this has anything to do with what's going on right now?
Most definitely. The UC president, Mark Udoff, addressed to the chancellor in June that she needed to fix the situation for African-American students on the campus, because although the incidents are coming to light now, a lot of incidents like this have happened in the past, and it's just a very hostile environment for African-American students and underrepresented students on an everyday basis in the previous years. So I think that her lack of action to Mark Rudolph telling her to take action in June is why we are in the state we are now, as well as the Black Student Union wrote a report called the DUCS report in September and talked about there was testimonies talking about how bad the climate was for African-American students and made recommendations on how to fix that back in September.
And Professor Widener, what do you think of the administration's response and what needs to be done right now?
Initially, when asked, I called the administration's response tepid, and I'd like to stand by that statement. I think that the university has recognized that there's a problem, but it has yet to commit itself fully to implementing the kinds of solutions that have been laid out, not simply by the students in their Do You See Us document, which does have testimony, which does have suggestions, but also a history of reports initiated by Latino faculty, by African-American faculty, by multi-ethnic groups of faculty. There was a 2007 YIELD report aimed at democratizing and diversifying the campus. So this has been a subject of study, but it's never been a situation where the university would commit itself to allocating resources, funding students, scholarships for students, outreach and YIELD, and the kinds of things that would produce a student body, a population reflective of our state, reflective of the diversity of our state, and where the students would not feel outnumbered. We should not have a situation where every student knows every other student by name. This is not a small liberal arts college. We have 24,000 undergraduates. So I think that the research has been done. The question is whether or not the university has the will to make the choices that will prevent these kinds of incidents in the future and in the present.
And the significance of, well, this being a decade after a California ballot proposition barred the use of race and ethnicity in admissions decisions, University of California continues to struggle to diversify its campuses. Black and Latino enrollment has plummeted.
Yes, I think that it has to be said that the students have launched a battle against the resegregation of higher education. It's a battle that's tied to the privatization of higher education, the idea that only those who can afford a top-grade education should receive one, and that those should be the people who are the doctors, the attorneys, the chemists, and the other professional class for the future. And what the students have put on the line is the idea that a 60- or 70-year-old African-American man could have a doctor who looks like him to talk about prostate cancer with, that a Latina who's accused of a crime could have an attorney who could communicate with her in her defense, that these students are fighting not just for the UC campuses, not just for UC San Diego, but for the future of people of color in this state. And I think that it's very important that people throughout the country try to do what they can to mobilize to help us, whether that's emailing our chancellor@ucsd.edu, calling her office at 858-534-3135, or looking at a website that the students have put out called stopracismucsd.wordpress.com. These are all things that people can do immediately now to help us build pressure for change.
And, Fanon, finally, there are major protests planned, is this right, for Thursday?
Thursday's March 4th, which is actually a statewide day of action for educational justice and educational equality. It's been planned for months now, and so we definitely think that the situation that's at hand right now with the campus climate at UCSD ties in to March 4th and what March 4th is standing for and what it's fighting for.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us, Professor Widener, Daniel Widener, Associate Professor of History and Faculty Director of the African American Studies Minor at UC San Diego, and Fanon Kavlevzegi, co-chair of the UC San Diego Black Student Union. Thank you for joining us. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Searching my soul, I know what I want, but I just don't know how to go about getting it. Feeling, sweet feeling, drops from my fingers. Manic depression is capturing my soul. I wish I could caress, caress, caress. Manic depression is a...
Manic Depression by Jimi Hendrix here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Is depression manufactured? 2 decades after the introduction of antidepressants, it's become commonplace to assume that our sadness can be explained in terms of a disease called depression. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates more than 14 million Americans suffer from major depression every year, and more than 3 million suffer from minor depression. Some 30 million Americans take antidepressants at a cost of over $10 billion a year. Well, my next guest argues, while depression can be debilitating, it's also been largely manufactured by doctors and drug companies as a medical condition with a biological cause that can be treated with prescription medication. Psychotherapist and writer Gary Greenberg participated in a clinical trial for antidepressant medication and found that, more often than not, the drugs fail to outperform placebos. His latest book is a scientific, medical, historical, and cultural exploration of the antidepressant revolution here in the United States. It's called Manufacturing Depression, the Secret History of a Modern Disease. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's good to be here.
Tell us about the trial you went through.
I enrolled in a trial at Mass General Hospital, intending, actually, to enroll in a trial for minor depression. But the tests that I took showed that I had major depression. And the trial was a trial of fish oil. Versus placebo, which meant that I was taking omega-3 fatty acids or placebo. I didn't know which.
And what happened?
What happened was that I returned to Mass General every other week for 2 months, and I was given the same battery of tests over and over again. And as the time went on, I appeared to be getting better on the tests that were being used to measure my depression. At the end of the trial, I asked if I could be told if I was on the placebo or the drug, and they told me no. But since it was the next to the last day of the trial, I still had some pills left. I sent them off to a lab, and it turned out I was on the placebo.
What did you think?
I thought that was really interesting. And I thought that it was more interesting that the doctors really assumed that I was on the drug. The way I know that is because after the trial was over, they offered me what's called an open label trial, where I would get what I knew to be, in this case, fish oil, which is standard for clinical trials. If they think the subject was on the drug, they offer them the drug after the trial is over, even if they have no way of knowing.
So talk about your overall thesis in this book, Manufacturing Depression, 2 decades after. 2 decades after exactly what?
Well, it's 2 decades after Prozac was introduced, which saw an explosion of two things. One of them is sales of antidepressants in the Prozac generation, and the other is the rates of diagnosis of depression. And in the book, what I'm trying to do is to show how these two things go together, and how, in many respects, the drugs came first, and how this was something that has grown historically for at least 150 years. We've been heading in this direction. And basically what the book is about is why it even makes sense at this point for people who are unhappy to even think about the possibility that they have a mental illness. And in the book, I'm mostly interested to say that our concern probably shouldn't be so much with the drugs themselves as the meaning that we have for why we're taking the drugs, which I believe shapes our response to the drugs. And that what really we should be paying attention to is how easily people are diagnosed with mental illnesses, as opposed to given other explanations or opportunities for themselves to explain why they might be suffering.
Go on with that.
Where do you want me to go?
No. On that issue of how people get diagnosed and when drugs are prescribed for them.
Well, people get diagnosed largely by their family doctors, and sometimes only implicitly. In other words, you go to your doctor and you have some complaints about sleeplessness or nervousness or unhappiness or demoralization, and the doctor will give you a prescription often for Prozac after asking some intelligent questions or some other antidepressant besides Prozac. And he may not say, you know, you are depressed. He may just give you the drug. But you've seen enough on TV, in ads, and heard enough to know what the deal is. You don't need a weatherman to know which way that wind blows. Or he does tell you that you're depressed and explains to you that it's a biochemical imbalance. And so when you take the drug, if you feel better, then indeed that confirms that you were sick in the first place. And I'm not sure that it's necessary to do that in order to get the whatever benefits there are of these drugs.
Today we're seeing a major recession. Jobs, unemployment, people can get very depressed. What happens? What do you think should happen? How should this be dealt with?
Well, I don't know that we're that far off. I mean, there's no reason people shouldn't confide in their doctors or their therapists about how unhappy they are. But to be told that you have a biochemical illness is automatically to distract your attention from those kinds of conditions that you just mentioned. In fact, I think that the American Psychiatric Association is going to move even farther away from any kind of consideration of causes that come from the outside in their next edition of the DSM. They're eliminating, at least they're planning.
Explain the DSM.
The DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Diagnosis. It lists the diagnoses of official mental illnesses. Right now, if you're simply suffering from bereavement, somebody dies, you can't be diagnosed as depressed unless your unhappiness lasts for more than 2 months. In the next edition, they may remove even that as an exception to the diagnosis of depression.
And so they remove what?
The bereavement exception. So, in other words, if you're bereaved now, you meet all the criteria for depression, but you can't be diagnosed because you were bereaved. Research shows that bereavement isn't any different from other psychosocial stressors like unemployment, like divorce. So rather than grapple with that, the American Psychiatric Association seems to be moving in the direction of simply eliminating the exception. So what I'm getting at is that it's very difficult in the context of a doctor's visit, because doctors aren't trained to do this, to talk with people about how their world might be at least part of why they're demoralized.
And then take that a step further.
Well, if people then are encouraged to think of external circumstances, then they may be more empowered to take action. They may be more ready to consider the possibility that what they need to do is engage somewhere in the politics of their world. They may be ready to tell their own story about what depression is about rather than the biomedical story.
We're talking to Gary Greenberg, who has written the book Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Talk about how the definition has changed over the decades and how we deal with it in this country.
The definition of depression has been changing since it was first introduced as a medical concept, which was about a little more than 100 years ago. But the most radical changes have occurred after 1973, when the American Psychiatric Association had suffered a series of embarrassments, including particularly the discovery suddenly that homosexuality really wasn't a disease. And they were forced to grapple with the fact that they not only were their questions about whether their diseases really were diseases, but doctors couldn't agree on the same patient what disease that patient had. And so they went to a system of diagnosis that's purely a checklist. If you meet the criteria, then regardless of your circumstances, you have the disease. And that's how depression works. And so over time, what's happened is that the diagnosis has gotten increasingly detached from any sense of where it might come from, either within the psyche, as Freud would talk about, or from external circumstances, as more politically minded psychologists would talk about. And that, of course, goes hand in hand with the idea that it's a biochemical illness, because if it's not being caused by your external circumstances and it's not being caused by some, you know, childhood trauma, then what's left? It must be being caused by something inside your brain, and it's become a brain disease.
What role do pharmaceutical companies play in
this? Well, pharmaceutical companies have been very eager to jump on that bandwagon. In fact, in many respects, they've originated that idea, or at least spread it through the culture like a virus. Since about 1960, the drug industry has been actively engaged in trying to help first doctors and now patients come believe that demoralization is really a mental illness. They've done it through very clever marketing. For instance, they distributed 50,000 copies of a book called Recognizing the Depressed Patient to prominent doctors back in the early 1960s, in which the biochemical argument was made for the first time in the almost entire absence of any findings that supported it. It was like a myth that was being given to the doctors to pass along to their patients, like viral marketing. Now, with TV direct-to-consumer ads, every time there's an advertisement for Prozac, it's also an advertisement for the idea that depression is a disease. And I think that's very obviously very beneficial to the drug companies.
At the end of your book, your final chapter is The Magnificence of Normal. What does that mean?
Well, in my book, I try to grapple with the possibility that there might be something redemptive about large groups of people thinking of themselves as sick, as is what's happening right now if 20% of the population is depressed. And I visited with some people who take that line. Unfortunately, what they do with their collective action is they decide to treat themselves as chronically ill people and to demand better drugs and to demand nothing but the restoration of normalcy in what they consider to be their brain illness. Now, I don't mean to criticize people who are really struggling to just get by every day. But for most of us, the idea that the normal is what's magnificent is a problem, because it gives very little room for challenging or questioning the status quo. So in the end, we can see that this idea that depression is a biochemical illness, no matter how the intentions, or what the intentions were, which were probably good intentions, it doesn't matter, because that idea is going to favor the status quo no matter what we do, if there's not built into it some understanding of the way our engagements with the world contribute to the way that we're unhappy.
What about antidepressants in children?
I don't know much about antidepressants in children, except I know that it's a science experiment that everybody's involved in right now, that nobody's actually been asked to consent to. We don't really understand how Prozac works in grown-ups. We know that if you put it into the system, you get a better mood out of the system after, in many cases. But with children, we have no idea what constantly tweaking their brain metabolism. We don't know what the effects of that are going to be on a brain that's still developing. So while there may be situations in which it can be valuable, I think that we're moving very, very fast, considering we know very little about how the drugs work in the brain, and we know very little about the developing brain. So you put those two things together, that's a lot of ignorance.
Gary Greenberg, you're a psychotherapist. You have been through trials yourself. But when you were researching manufacturing depression's secret history of modern disease, what most surprised you?
I think the thing that most surprised me was to discover just how easily ferreted out this history is. I mean, if you sit down and you look at the way medicine has developed for the last 150 years, while you probably couldn't have predicted it from 1850, looking back, it's a complex history, but it's a very clear line from the first discovery of magic bullet drugs in the late 19th century, and the idea that our diseases are suffering can be understood as medical diseases, to the idea that this kind of suffering can be understood as a biomedical disease. I mean, the book was really hard to write, don't get me wrong. I earned my money, but it was really also a a surprisingly straight line. It was how easily or quickly things fell into place to show that history. And I think that that's important for people who might read the book, because when you read it, you see how you've really arrived on a wave that's been building for 150 years. When you get to your doctor's office and he starts to talk to you about your depression, you're really at the end of a long line of events that, if you know about them, they really change the way that whole experience goes and the way you understand what your demoralization is about and the way you understand being told that you're depressed.
Gary Greenberg, I want to thank you for being with us. Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease is his book. That does it for the show. Very happy birthday to my nephew, Jasper, who's hitting the double digits, 10 years old. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.